Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Hello and welcome to a special edition of Mormon Stories Podcast / Mormon Stories Book Club. I am your host, John DeLynn, and I'm very excited to have with us today author and professor John G. Turner. He is the author of the brand new biography on Brigham Young entitled Brigham Young, Pioneer Prophet, and he's the feature today of Mormon Stories Book Club. I also have joining us today the distinguished Morris Thurston. Morris is an attorney, a retired attorney. He lives in Orange County. He's been on Mormon Stories several times before. He's also, I believe, the chair-elect of the Dialogue Foundation, active participant in Mormon Studies. He was a participant on the Joseph Smith Papers Project. He's done a lot in doing sort of legal analyses of Proposition 8 and the church's position on gay marriage. So, John Turner, welcome to Mormon Stories.
Thanks for having me, John. Pleasure to be here.
And Morris, welcome to you as well.
It's great to be here, John. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm going to just, audience, a couple things to note. First of all, we've actually conducted this interview once already. We conducted it a week or two ago. We had Heather Olson Beale and Max Mueller on, in addition to John Turner and Morris Thurston. But the audio software actually didn't record the first hour and a half. And I feel horrible about that, but the software just failed us. So we're going to take some precautions. But I want to give a shout out to Max and Heather, especially Heather, for planning and arranging this entire interview. She's sort of taken the lead on Mormon Stories Book Club. And so I want to thank her and also thank Max for joining us and tell him how sorry we are that he couldn't join us today. Let me just tell everyone really quickly about Mormon Stories Book Club and what it's about. This is the second in a series. The first one was with Joanna Brooks in August when we featured Book of Mormon Girl. But here's how it works. We provide a link to Amazon where you can purchase the book in question. Right now, if you go up to mormonstories.org, Brigham Young Pioneer Prophet is featured in the left-hand toolbar. You can click on that link and purchase the book. We've had dozens of people already buy John's book, even before we've actually recorded this podcast, so we're happy about that. And a little bit of the money will come to Mormon Stories. If it's a way for you to support Mormon Stories and good literature. But also, the way that we're setting this up is that we're going to do this initial interview with John Turner and allow you to listen to it. And then we're going to encourage you to hold book clubs all over the country in your local area through your Mormon Stories Facebook community and other friends and family or ward members that you have. And we're providing all sorts of supplemental materials for you to read up on the book to prepare yourselves for a book club discussion. We've set up a Facebook group called Mormon Stories Book Club where you can go and actually interact with John Turner and ask him questions. And for those who are able to gather book clubs of, let's say, 10 to 20 people, John Turner has actually expressed a willingness, and this will be the same with other authors, to actually appear at your book clubs via Skype if you live far away from the D.C. area. Is that where you live, John?
That's right. We're in Northern Virginia.
Yeah. So if you live near Northern Virginia, he might even be willing to visit your book club personally. We have a vibrant Mormon Stories group in Washington, D.C. But also, he's willing to appear at your book clubs via Skype. You know, if you have a big enough group to sort of, you know, make it worth everyone's while. So that's what Mormon Stories Book Club is about. I also want to just let you know that you can purchase anything through Amazon Stories. You can purchase anything through Amazon through a link on Mormon Stories, and that will just give Mormon Stories a little bit of extra financial support. But that's not important right now. The most important thing is for you to buy John's book, Brigham Young Pioneer Prophet, and we're going to now jump in to feature that book. Before we jump in, John, I thought it would be interesting to begin by having you read an excerpt from your book. I was, rereading through it today, and the prologue just jumped out at me as a fascinating and captivating introduction to the personality of Brigham Young. So it is a few paragraphs, but I think it's worth reading to sort of set up what's going to be our discussion. So would you mind reading the first few paragraphs from your prologue?
Sure.
All right.
On New Year's Day, 1877, Brigham Young and nearly 1,300 Latter-day Saints gathered in the southern Utah settlement of St. George. They came to dedicate a temple, the first the church had completed since fleeing Illinois 31 years earlier. For 3 hours, Mormon leaders offered lengthy prayers consecrating the new building. At the end of the services, Young finally arose. He was ailing from rheumatism and unable to walk. Several men had helped him into and around the temple in a sedan chair on rollers. Despite his infirmities, a man who had delivered thousands of discourses over the past 45 years would not allow this occasion to pass without comment. He began by reminding the congregation of the occasion's historic significance. The Mormons had dedicated two temples before the one in St. George, but now they would have the time to introduce what he considered the full range of sacred rituals for the first time. "We that are here," Young said, "are enjoying a privilege that we have no knowledge of any other people enjoying since the days of Adam." Church members could perform all the rituals necessary to ensure their own eternal exaltation, and they could perform the same ordinances as proxies for their ancestors. "Can the fathers be saved without us?" Young asked. "No." "Can we be saved without them?" "No." Combined with other ordinances that would bind children to parents and adopt men to spiritual fathers, Young envisioned these rituals as binding together a great chain of redeemed humanity stretching back to Adam. Given the sacred importance of this task," he suggested, "the house of the Lord should be crowded after its dedication." Then Young's tone gradually changed. Despite the sacrifices of the Mormons who had built the temple, he feared that church members were more worried about money than the eternal fates of their ancestors. They would choose a single dollar over eternal life, and they would give away the people's wealth to their enemies. Some of this people, he complained, if they had the power, would build a railroad to the bottomless pit and would send all they had and the earth besides to the devil. Too many of the Mormon people, he said, were damned fools. Young demanded that his people mirror his own commitment to the kingdom of God. "Let those infernal holes in the ground alone," he instructed the audience, "and let the Gentiles alone, who would destroy us if they had the power." If they did not heed his words, there would be consequences. "You will go to hell, lots of you, unless you repent," he warned. Building to a crescendo, Young upbraided those who were satisfied with the temple's dedication, a symbol of the Mormons' spiritual commitment and material progress. "I am not half satisfied," Young thundered as much as his aging lungs would permit, "and I never expect to be satisfied until the devil is whipped and driven from off the face of the earth." To drive home his final sentence, Young took a hickory cane filled with knots and struck the pulpit with such power that he buried 3 of the knots into the solid wood. The noise reverberated around the hall, and visitors to the temple a century later could still see the marks. Young's spirit and determination were as strong as his body was weak. He was blunt-spoken, pugnacious, and sometimes profane. Through his dedication, energy, and tenacity, he had built an earthly kingdom for the Mormon people, and he would fight to defend it until his final breath.
Beautiful. I'm so happy you were willing to read that. Well, John Turner, let's start by just having you tell just a tiny bit about yourself, just sort of career-wise and academically. And then the big question that I wanted to start with was what got you interested in Brigham Young?
Sure. Thinking about how far to go back, I grew up outside of Rochester, New York, and at some point I became aware of the Latter-day Saints as a piece of local history. And then by the time I got to graduate school, I was interested in the history of religion in the United States. Didn't actually focus on Mormonism while I was a graduate student or writing my first book. It was about evangelicalism. But I developed a little bit of curiosity about the Latter-day Saints. I had some good Mormon classmates in graduate school. That piqued my curiosity a little bit. And I think if you're interested in the history of religion in the United States, it's hard not to get at least a little bit interested in the Mormons. The 19th century story in particular is so dramatic and colorful. About 5 years ago, I was looking for a new research project, and I thought about doing a project on Mormons and politics in the United States since World War II, which also I think would have been timely. But as I started to read up, about Mormon history, I got drawn back into that 19th century, and I saw Brigham Young as a towering figure, not only for the history of Mormonism, but also for the history of the United States more broadly in the 19th century. It had been a while since anyone had written a full biography of Brigham Young, and so I plunged into it as a way of partly satisfying my own curiosity about the church's history.
And you grew up evangelical, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Somewhere between evangelical and mainline Protestantism, but yeah, no, I kind of came of age spiritually as a young person through evangelical organizations like Young Life and InterVarsity, which probably have not historically had very good relationships with Latter-day Saints, for all I know. So yeah, I'm kind of somewhere between evangelical and mainline Protestantism. I tend to like the piety of evangelicalism without liking what I consider to be its kind of superficiality and politicization.
Right. So, had you heard of, how much, I'm just trying to imagine someone who doesn't necessarily know a lot about Mormonism, who didn't grow up in the Mormon faith, deciding to tackle a biography of such a large historical character. And as someone who's a bit of an insider who knows that Leonard Arrington, who's well respected as sort of like the grandfather of modern, Mormon, historiography. I don't know if those are the right terms, but he's definitely a towering figure in Mormon history in the mid to late 20th century. I imagine feeling intimidated at writing a biography, knowing that Leonard Arrington had made an attempt. So, what was it? Did you feel any of those kind of pressures, either about the largeness of Brigham Young or following Leonard Arrington, as you sort of decided to take on this task? Did it feel like a big task to you, or did it just kind of grow in a way to where it wasn't that, overwhelming or monumental in your considerations?
Well, I think I was too ignorant at the outset to realize what a foolhardy sort of project it was, honestly. I mean, one of the first things I did was, naturally read the existing biographies of Brigham Young, or at least several, including Leonard Arrington's. I guess the first thing that struck me was Just in the sense of time passing, it's been a long time since American Moses had been published. When I started the project, it had already been a little bit more than 20 years. And in terms of scholarship and academia, that's a long time. And I knew that there had been a lot of fabulous books and articles on Mormon history published since then. So I knew just on the face of it that there would be plenty of new things to say. So the fact that American Moses existed wasn't intimidating. I also thought, just from the initial time I spent with the literature, that while American Moses was a tremendous step forward in terms of using the primary sources of the Brigham Young papers and other collections, I thought that there was a lot more to say about quite a few topics, ranging from plural marriage to Mountain Meadows, to Brigham Young's theology. Leonard Arrington was trained as first and foremost an economic historian. My focus has always been the history of religion and its intersection with politics. So I thought also in that sense, I'd probably, be taking a somewhat different approach. So no, that wasn't intimidating. I probably didn't really understand the absolute mountain of sources that one is blessed with when, well, not just doing a project on Brigham Young, but on almost anything pertaining to 19th century Mormonism.
Okay, well that's great. That's a great background. Real quick, after you really got to know Brigham Young through your readings, you mentioned wanting to talk, that there was some new information about, let's say, his plural marriages or Mountain Meadows or his theology. Was there something about his personality that either captivated you or that you sort of felt compelled to want to share? In other words, maybe in a biography you get a chance to paint the personality of a historical figure. And were there elements of his personality that you either felt attracted to or sympathized with or felt compelled to want to share and to highlight for the interested audiences?
Lots of things, John. I wanted to capture the spiritual fire that animated Brigham Young during his early years as a missionary. I mean, he more or less was almost a full-time missionary from the church from his conversion in 1832 until Joseph Smith's murder. And, he was a fiery speaker. He spoke with some frequency in spiritual tongues. He was a fierce advocate for Joseph Smith. So I wanted to capture those elements of his early personality. I wanted to capture the tender letters that he wrote to his wife, Mary Ann Angel, during those years. I also wanted to capture some of the changes in his personality produced by the traumatic experiences of the mid-1840s, starting with Joseph's murder. He became a man who was much more burdened by fear and anxiety, someone who could be vindictive toward fellow church leaders and antagonistic toward outsiders. And so I wanted to capture the complexity of his personality and get as close to Brigham Young as I could, the closest accounts of his sermons and people who were with him at the time.
John, let me just ask something. You've mentioned some things that took place early in Brigham Young's life, or at least before they got to Utah. And I think a lot of our listeners are probably a lot less familiar with Brigham Young's early life than they are his later life. But I found that section of your book to be really enlightening. In particular, I think there was a time, it might be helpful for you just to set the stage with Brigham Young. How old was he compared to Joseph Smith? Did he come from the same part of the country? And then, as far as his background goes, when he was 16 years old, his father basically said, "You're on your own." And they weren't a well-to-do family to begin with. He had not had much education. Hardly the sort of thing that one would expect, or a background of one would expect of a future leader of a, you know, an American Moses type history. So perhaps you could just tell us a little about his early years.
Sure. It's a great question. And there's, you know, there's some similarity between Brigham Young's background and Joseph Smith's, quite a lot of similarity. You know, their families both moved from Vermont to New York. Brigham was about 4 years older than Joseph Smith. Both families were poor, mostly rural. Brigham Young had a very impoverished upbringing, you know, no formal education. His mother died when he was around 13 or 14 years old. And then you're right, after his father remarries, he basically tells Brigham that it's time for him to be independent. Now, being independent at age 16 was not quite as unusual then as it would be now, but still, I think it was pretty tough sledding for him as a young man. And he, for a while, followed in his father's footsteps of moving from place to place, trying to find a way to get ahead economically and not succeeding at that. He was also a bit of a spiritual seeker or drifter even. He had a conversion to a restorationist branch of Methodism called the Reformed Methodist Church. And ultimately, that experience left him unsatisfied. I think some of those who sought salvation through evangelical conversion didn't find the assurance of salvation they were seeking. And Brigham Young was in that category, and it left him feeling utterly despondent about his spiritual state, and I think about the state of churches that he encountered as well.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
Will you tell us really quickly what you mean by restorationist and what that means?
Well, in the context of most Protestant restorationist movements, it meant attempting to restore at least elements of the New Testament church. So the Reformed Methodists, for instance, focused on restoring the gift of spiritual healing as it had been practiced in early years of Christianity. They also founded a communitarian settlement. This was before Brigham Young and his family were involved. You know, they saw that as also restoring an aspect of economic cooperation and sharing that's described in the Book of Acts. So they were focused on restoring New Testament Christianity. And I think that when Brigham Young then encounters Joseph Smith, a prophet who talks about restoring the ancient order of things, you know, that makes sense to him. In a way, I think he's preconditioned to a certain extent to at least take seriously the claims of Joseph Smith and this other version of restorationism.
So,
and apparently, John, it was not only Brigham Young, but many of his extended family. It might just, again, by way of setting the stage, it might be helpful just to tell us about it, because he had quite a few siblings, right?
He did. He had something like five brothers and some sisters as well. And it more or less was a family conversion. One of his older brothers seems to have led the way, or perhaps even a couple of them. And Brigham himself spent almost 2 years considering the claims of the Book of Mormon before seeking baptism, along with other members of his family, and then quite a few members of the Young family finally are baptized in the spring of 1832.
And so how old would Brigham have been when he started reading the Book of Mormon?
Just shy of 30.
Okay.
Just shy of 30 years old. And then he's almost 32 at the time of his conversion. What really seems to have influenced him to crossing that threshold of converting and seeking baptism was seeing a group of Mormon elders, you know, traveling missionaries, speak in tongues. I think for him that was a clear display of God's power and presence, and helped him overcome some of the hesitation that he had experienced.
That's so fascinating, because we don't speak in tongues today.
No, a church. Presbyterians don't either. So no, it's foreign. It's foreign, and something so associated with Pentecostalism, and you know, something that begins in the early 1900s, but it was a prevalent part of early Mormon spirituality.
Now, was Brigham Young, first of all, who do we know who the missionaries were? That was he tracked out by missionaries? Did he have a relationship with?
You know, I don't know the extent to which he really had a relationship with these traveling elders. Eliezer Miller is the elder who ultimately baptizes him. There are several others. The names escape me at the moment.
Oh, that's fine.
There was one, though, I think, the one that initially contacted him, if I recall your book correctly, John, was one of the first, if not the first, missionaries sent out by the church. Maybe I got that wrong.
Yeah, you know, Brigham's brother Phinehas encounters Samuel Smith, Joseph Smith's brother, very shortly after the publication of the Book of Mormon. And then Phinehas, Joseph Young, and Brigham Young all have interactions with Solomon Chamberlain, who's an early believer in the Book of Mormon and a visionary himself. And they, you know, ultimately all of them conclude, I think, that what they had been searching for in Reformed Methodism, they found in Mormonism.
Talk just briefly about his professional life leading up to joining the church, and also his married life, just so we can get a sense of what state he was in when he joined the Mormon community.
Sure. Well, he's married to Miriam Works. He married her in 1825. They had two daughters. And at the time of their conversion, she joined the church a little while after he did. She was dying from tuberculosis. And there are some of his recollections suggest that it was an incredible ordeal for him to be working, caring for his daughters, caring for his wife, during, you know, perhaps that last year or two of her life. And she died in September, a few months after their conversion. Economically, he was a craftsman. I think he did a number of jobs, but was most accomplished as a furniture maker. And you know, he also worked on the construction of buildings. He worked on a printing press at one time. He did quite a few different things. I know he wasn't getting ahead economically. His father had purchased some land outside of Rochester, New York. And at one point, Brigham and his brother Phinehas purchased some land as well. But they quickly get behind on the payments and have to sell.
That's kind of another similarity to Joseph, just kind of financial struggles leading up to heavy church involvement.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, there's certainly no sense that Brigham Young's life had any clear direction or upward trajectory before his conversion to Mormonism.
One thing I liked about your book, John, is that you would often quote Brigham Young, and you would quote him with the original spellings if he was writing a letter, for example. And it's clear that his ability to spell as an adult was probably on a par with, you know, my six-year-old grandson. I mean, it was a totally phonetic type spelling.
Or with Joseph Smith, right? Right, Morris?
Yeah, although I don't recall Joseph Smith's spelling being as bad as Brigham Young's.
No, okay. Brigham's is worse. I think that's true. Yeah, no, and actually I found that a very endearing thing.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, and you know, it wasn't so uncommon in the 1800s, especially the early 1800s, for people to employ incredibly irregular spelling. It's a much smaller percentage of people had formal education, and you know, things in general were a little less standardized. Brigham Young, you know, after his conversion, he keeps a diary especially during his missionary travels. He writes letters, in particular when he's in charge of the mission to England in 1840 and 1841. He often, you know, sits down and writes long letters to his fellow apostles. And that strikes me as something that must have been rather burdensome for him. And he would sometimes write at the end, you know, please excuse errors. Once in a while, he'd put a note on or a postscript on a letter to his wife and something to the effect of, you know, don't show this to everyone. You know, I know my handwriting and spelling are terrible. That's not, I'm very roughly paraphrasing him. But, you know, I kind of think of him, you know, almost slaving away to do that sort of official writing in particular at times. Right.
One more question about his conversion. Do we have a sense for whether the Book of Mormon played a pivotal role in his conversion?
Well, I think it did, but not in a straightforward way of reading it and believing it, and not in a straightforward way of the contents of the Book of Mormon having a big influence on him at the time. I think he did, when he encountered the book, he did take it as a sign of God's renewed presence in the world and God acting as he had acted in previous eras of history. So I think he was moved by the appearance of the Book of Mormon, but I don't think his conversion primarily rested on him, you know, reading the Book of Mormon, reflecting on the book, contemplating on the book, and then deciding to believe. I think the interactions ultimately with other believers were most instrumental.
Did he meet Joseph before joining?
No, he traveled to meet him shortly afterwards. Shortly after his wife's death, he and his friend Heber Kimball traveled to Kirtland. And he found Joseph Smith chopping wood in the forest. And he later talked about really being so pleasantly surprised at how down to earth Joseph Smith was, that he didn't put on any sort of airs as a prophet. He was just seemed very much like an, you know, ordinary person that Brigham Young could relate to. At the same time, that those days with Joseph Smith during that first trip to Kirtland certainly convinced Brigham Young that Joseph Smith was a prophet, which is something he never wavered about for the remaining 45 years of his life.
And was it soon thereafter that Brigham was called as a missionary?
Well, he had already been... He'd already been serving as a missionary. The first thing he writes in his diary post conversion, you know, he makes a note that he was baptized in April of 1832, and then pretty much his next sentence is, "I preached as opportunity presented."
So that's called a golden convert in Mormonism.
Yeah, well, it was not unusual. You know, other early converts like Parley Pratt had very similar experiences. You know, I think he simply wanted to go out and share with others this experience that so quickly transformed his life. He wrote in his diary, "I was ordained to the office of an elder before my clothes were dry upon me." So, you know, he simply immediately goes out and preaches first in Menden, and then he travels these Reformed Methodist circuits, especially in Canada, and, you know, talks to many people he had known within the orbit of Methodism, and is fairly successful at gaining, you know, several dozen converts over the next couple of years.
And this is traveling without purse or script, just
absolutely, and trudging through mud and ice, you know, making a sacrifice for his new faith. And you know, later on in life, he would, you know, when others would complain about what they were having to sacrifice, he would often refer back to these early years of missionary service, as if to say, you know, I've made these sorts of sacrifices. You know, you shouldn't complain. It's now your turn to put your shoulder to the wheel, so to speak.
I get the sense that he was rarely living in the same city as the prophet. And for some reason, I get the sense that he spent most of his time overseas in Europe. Talk a bit about how he goes from meeting Joseph to kind of what his involvement in the church is while Joseph's still alive.
Well, you know, it's back and forth. I haven't really calculated it, but I would say it's about half of his time in the same place as Joseph, and then about half as a missionary. And he's only overseas. It's really a 2 year or 2.5 year trip from Illinois to England and back. So much of the time he is with Joseph Smith, but it's inconstant. He moves to Kirtland in, I think, 1833. He remarries in 1834. He goes with Joseph Smith to Missouri in the Zion's Camp March, which is also a formative experience for him.
Was that a challenge to his faith at all? I mean, for our listeners who don't know about Zion's Camp, you know, the saints in Missouri were getting persecuted, as I understand it. Talk a bit about Zion's Camp and whether that tested Brigham Young's faith, because it was such a, some would say it was such a failure of an expedition, but I imagine failure is a matter of perspective.
That's absolutely correct. Well, the saints in Jackson County, Missouri, had been basically just kicked off of their land, and they go and several leaders go to Kirtland and really expect Joseph Smith, I think, to do something about it. And he decides to march a very makeshift army, if you will, to Missouri and help the Jackson County Saints reclaim their property. He's had some assurance from the governor of Missouri that he'll be supported in this. That turns out not to be the case. And when this army, kind of just a ragtag army, reaches Missouri, it does turn into a debacle. It's clear that they're not going to be able to reclaim the land. Then there's a cholera epidemic that claims a number of lives. But no, that doesn't shake Brigham Young's faith at all. For him, I think it was a precious opportunity to be with Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith explained the setbacks of Zion's Camp as a result of the people's own transgressions. And also God's providence. And it didn't shake Brigham Young's faith to march with Joseph Smith to Missouri and back. You know, I think he simply viewed those sorts of setbacks through a different lens, through a lens of faith in Joseph Smith. Those sorts of experiences didn't disrupt his faith in Joseph as a prophet.
Well, there's a saying that familiarity breeds contempt, and you know, as you kind of trace the church's history up to 1838 or so, you know, by the time 1838, 1839 rolls around, you've got members of the First Presidency and a significant number of apostles being excommunicated, and people left and right not only losing their faith in Joseph Smith, but even turning against him. What was it about Brigham Young or Brigham Young's relationship with Joseph that made it so that he didn't lose faith in Joseph and stayed a staunch supporter when so many others seemed to wither?
It's a great question. Ultimately, maybe it's hard to say, but my sense of Brigham Young is that he saw Joseph Smith as the prophet who had brought forth the Book of Mormon, who had reestablished God's church. And through that, Brigham Young had finally found the assurance of salvation that he hadn't been able to find through Reformed Methodism. I can't really ultimately explain why Mormonism satisfied those spiritual urgings in him and evangelical Protestantism did not, but that definitely was the case. And I think in Brigham Young's mind, through Joseph Smith, God had brought him these things that he had long sought. And so why doubt in the face of setbacks? But you're absolutely right. Many other people fell away during these years. And Brigham Young certainly recognized deficiencies in Joseph Smith's leadership at times. He didn't think that Joseph Smith's financial management was perhaps all it could have been. And he didn't think that Joseph handled dissent as he should have, that he should have taken a harder line toward dissenters within the church. So it's not that Brigham Young had blinders on to Joseph's human frailties, but I think he simply resolved that he wasn't going to let those frailties interfere with him following Joseph as a prophet. So he remained a very stalwart supporter of Joseph Smith when many other people questioned him, which is one reason he rose in Joseph's estimation.
Because of his loyalty.
Absolutely, yeah.
Was there anything about the seniority and the disaffection of certain apostles that made it, in terms of seniority, such that Brigham Young was then set up later to become Joseph's successor as a result of these apostasies in 38 and 39?
Sure. Well, by the time Joseph Smith is in jail in Missouri, Brigham Young is the most senior remaining member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. He's actually 2 weeks older than Heber C. Kimball. And so when Joseph Smith writes from Liberty Jail, I think it's from Liberty Jail, and says that, you know, leadership of the 12 is going to devolve upon the most senior member. He may not even have been sure if it was Brigham Young or Heber Kimball, but it was Brigham. So that's, you know, it's just kind of luck and happenstance. You know, by the time of Joseph Smith's murder, I don't think that Joseph left any clear instructions as to who should succeed him. But Brigham Young, as president of the Quorum of the 12, and as someone who is intimately at the center of Joseph Smith's introduction of ordinances during those years, is in a position in which he can claim leadership of the church for the 12.
I think it's interesting to contemplate how history might have been different had this sort of serendipitous occurrence not happened. For example, had David Patton, who was the most senior apostle, not been killed in Missouri, had Brigham been just a few weeks younger,
right,
than Heber, you know, how would those men have perhaps handled the whole issue of succession differently, and not to mention the trip to Utah and everything that followed after that.
Absolutely. Well, it's fun to speculate. You know, what would have happened to the church had Joseph Smith not been killed in 1844? You know, I mean, leadership matters. So, I mean, I think those are interesting questions. Not that there's any way of knowing what the answers are.
Real quick, since polygamy ends up defining Brigham Young to such a large extent, what can you tell us about how Brigham Young learned about the polygamy and whether he was excited or not excited, and what his early polygamous sort of involvement looked like when Joseph was still alive?
Great question. He learned about plural marriage sometime shortly after his return from England in 1841. By the next winter, he officiates at one of Joseph Smith's plural marriages. So within a span of less than a year, 8 months or so, he certainly accepts the doctrine. You know, for his initial responses, we have to rely upon his later recollections. He later said that it was the only time in his life that he desired the grave, which, you know, I think makes sense that he would have seen this as something that was going to, at the very least, disrupt his existing marriage, family life. I'm sure he sensed the potential that polygamy had to tear apart the church. He has other recollections where he sounds as if he found the doctrine more thrilling at the time, you know, that this would bring him privileges and power even that he hadn't previously experienced. So it's hard to know how to sort those out. Not a lot of men, when they reflected upon the introduction of plural marriage, talked about how exciting they found it at the time. You know, for, you know, they would kind of almost be distasteful to do so. So I don't know. I think there probably was a period of resistance, but it wasn't a long period. And I think, you know, there's a parallel with his conversion. You know, he's a man who deliberates, hesitates, but once he commits, he's fully committed and he doesn't look back.
I'm just wondering, you know, a lot of the critics will say that, oh, you know, these men like Martin Harris or the Whitmers, you know, they weren't very bright. They weren't necessarily very strong in character. And so they would be easily bamboozled, you know, by, again, what the critics would say, a charlatan like Joseph Smith. I'm wondering to what extent you found him to be a bright person, a person of integrity, a person of character, and if you found him and others around Joseph Smith to be, you know, quality people, to what extent that speaks to Joseph's power and influence to be able to do something as shocking as introduce plural marriage and still retain the faith and confidence of these men that probably had a lot of strength and character.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question. I certainly think that Brigham Young was a very intelligent man, not book learning, but just raw human intelligence. I think he certainly possessed that. I think, you know, he could be fairly shrewd. I don't think he was gullible. And I think for him, you know, it stems back to simply to seeing Joseph Smith as God's prophet. You know, when Joseph introduces the ordinance of baptism for the dead at roughly the same time, it's equally thrilling to Brigham Young and many other Latter-day Saints. And I think I'd love it if we were more privy to the conversations that Joseph had about plural marriage with men like Brigham Young during these years. We get some sense of those conversations from the Diary of William Clayton, but Brigham Young doesn't record his own interactions with Joseph in such detail at all. So to a certain extent, it's hard to know. I don't think that even Joseph Smith, and certainly not Brigham Young, had any clear sense of how this new practice was going to play out practically during these years. You know, it's only after Brigham Young leaves Nauvoo and heads west that he begins assembling a polygamous household. You know, he doesn't cohabit with the women he marries in Nauvoo. He doesn't begin having children with any of the women until after Joseph Smith's death. So during these early years, it's a little bit hard to know what he thought about these marriages.
That's interesting. So Joseph, we don't know of very many children Joseph had in his polygamous marriages in Nauvoo, and we don't know of any from Brigham either. Do we know of any, Morris, do you or John Turner, do you guys know if any children were born polygamous, you know, children of polygamous unions during the Nauvoo period, or do we even know that?
Well, I guess I'll maybe defer to John Turner, except to say that I know after Joseph's death, there were clearly cohabitations going on, and I suspect children were born. My own great-great-grandfather fathered the children by a polygamous wife, a child, but it was as they were leaving Nauvoo. I mean, it was within a few months after leaving Nauvoo.
That's interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think there's still debate about whether or not Joseph Smith ever had children by any of his plural wives. There are a couple of debatable cases. There are people who know a lot more about it than I do, so you should probably ask
yeah.
them. And
no,
I won't.
That's fair.
I won't speculate further. It's there is evidence that both Joseph and Brigham consummated at least some of these marriages during these years, and then he does begin to have children with his wives about the time that they're leaving Nauvoo. So, you know, there are conceptions before they leave, and several of his wives have children on the trail west. I think there are a couple who have children right before the Exodus or around the time of the Exodus.
And in fact, I now recall that on the Exodus, the first wagon train that Brigham Young led, there were like three women on the trip, one of whom was Brigham Young's wife. I think two of whom were Heber Kimball's wives, and one of them at least was pregnant.
Yeah.
Right, right. All right, John Turner. So before we leave Nauvoo, there's sort of this traditional story that many of us grew up with, dealing with, you know, after Joseph's death, Brigham comes into Nauvoo. You know, Sidney Rigdon thinks that he should be Joseph's successor. You know, Brigham kind of thinks he should be Joseph's successor. And they have this sort of showdown with all the people in Nauvoo where both of them give talks or speeches to the saints in Nauvoo. And there's a report, you know, several reports, maybe after the fact, that when Brigham's time came to speak to the people of Nauvoo, that some recall actually seeing or experiencing the aura or essence or voice or even image of Joseph Smith's face in Brigham Young as he's speaking to the saints in Nauvoo. Is that what the historical record actually bears out for you, or, you know, what's your understanding of that succession and how Brigham Young pulled it off?
Well, I don't think that a transfiguration would have been necessary for Brigham Young to carry the day, to persuade the majority of Nauvoo's Latter-day Saints that they should follow the apostles rather than Sidney Rigdon. And your question is correct, that there are a lot of reports of a miraculous transfiguration of sorts, so that people either saw or heard Joseph Smith when Brigham Young was talking. As far as I know, none of those reports are contemporaneous, which doesn't mean that that sort of miracle didn't happen, but we don't, you know, historians generally never, you never end up with evidence that really bears on such questions. You know, it's clear that very quickly a lot of people see Brigham Young as having inherited Joseph Smith's prophetic mantle. It escapes me if it's Wilford Woodruff or William Clayton. But in a letter between those two men in October, so 2 months later, the letter writer comments that the mantle of Joseph has fallen on Brother Brigham. I think a lot of people certainly saw it that way, that it wasn't just that the apostles had assumed leadership of the church. It was that Brigham Young had assumed leadership of the church, even though he didn't form a first presidency for another 3 years.
Do we know why he didn't do that?
Well, I think he didn't attempt to set himself up as Joseph's successor, and I think that's the main reason why he shied away from doing so. He very self-consciously did not attempt to imitate Joseph Smith's style of leadership during these years. And I think, you know, given the fact that many of the apostles were leery of reconstituting a first presidency when Brigham Young raises the idea 3 years later, suggests that many of them would have been wary of that in late 1844 as well. So it may have been pragmatic, or simply that he didn't feel comfortable doing that initially.
There's a sense that I've heard that I don't know if this is true, that sometimes he didn't even refer to himself as sort of the prophet, that it was more the president than the prophet. Is that your understanding?
Well, he gave that impression at times. He would, you know, sometimes say things that were self-deprecating about the issue of prophethood. He would say things like, "I don't know whether I'm a prophet, but I know that I've been profitable to this people." Hmm. He'd say, "You know, I don't know if I'm a prophet. I'm a Yankee guesser. You know, I can't predict the future. I'm just a Yankee guesser." But at the same time, I think he did see himself as a prophet. You know, he records a written revelation in 1847. He tells the people from, I think, as early as 1845, if not late in 1844, that they should regard his words as scripture, as revelation. And I think especially as the years pass by, he very much does see himself as a prophet.
You had inferred early on that Joseph's death and a lot of the adversity that he faced in those Nauvoo years really, really made a mark on his personality and character. Can you talk about that a little bit, about that change or transformation?
Sure. I think those 2 years from Joseph Smith's death until the saints leave Nauvoo were extremely traumatic and trying on Brigham Young. I mean, first of all, simply the loss of a man whom he loved was traumatic. Also, I think a sense that dissent within the church had led to Joseph's death, led to his murder, was very alarming. The fact that anti-Mormon mobs were still active in areas surrounding Nauvoo and posed a threat, not just to the church, but also a personal threat to Brigham Young, was very trying. You know, he carried weapons around Nauvoo. He slept in the Nauvoo Temple to avoid assassination or arrest. I think he keenly felt a burden, an intense burden of leadership during these years. He would talk about how he would have, you know, terrible headaches, and that sometimes he just wanted to withdraw by himself. So I think he very much was scarred by these experiences. He always feared that dissent within the church could lead to a reprise of what had taken place in Nauvoo, that there was a fragility about his leadership that dissent could threaten. And I don't think he ever really left behind the trauma of those years. I think it might have faded a little bit during the last decade or so of his life, but those wounds never really healed.
One of the things Brigham's known for that we can talk about in a bit is this whole notion of blood atonement. And I'm wondering if to what extent Brigham Young was involved in either the Council of 50 or the Danites, if there was any degree to which that involvement in, let's just say, some of the rougher, more violent aspects of sort of Nauvoo or late Missouri Mormonism in any way informed, you know, what some attribute to him as maybe some violent traits later on.
Sure. Well, I think from the time in Nauvoo after Joseph Smith's death, he thought that extra legal violence was one appropriate response to criminals and troublemakers. And you can see this very strongly once the Latter-day Saints are in Utah. You know, he will threaten people with violence. He not infrequently approved of extra legal violence after the fact. I don't really connect this to blood atonement per se. Sometimes he used that rhetoric when warning people to reform their behavior. And he would sometimes talk about, he would certainly talk about the fact that some sins were so grievous that only a sinner's own blood could atone for them, that Jesus' blood wouldn't suffice. And he talked about it being an act of charity for people to kill such sinners. I think that language, that particular language, was meant primarily to frighten people. And when there were instances of extra legal violence in Utah, I don't think those were done out of any theological charity toward the victims. You know, I think, you know, there are occasions when evidence suggests that Brigham Young may have authorized an act of violence, or at least approved of it afterwards. But I don't think those are really closely connected to blood atonement per se.
What about the Council of 50 stuff and the Danites?
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, Brigham Young was not involved with the Danites in Missouri. He does use the Council of 50 as kind of a pseudo legislature in both Nauvoo and then especially in the late 1840s in what becomes Deseret and then Utah. In the absence of any other civil government, the Council of 50, you know, really comes into its own as the political, you know, organization of the church. I don't think he ever saw it as having an independent authority beyond himself. But it was a group of men that he trusted, that he insisted keep things close to the vest. And then once the state of Deseret and then the territory of Utah are established, then the Council of 50 largely fades from significance.
Right.
You know, before we leave the subject of the blood atonement, just so that listeners aren't confused, I thought your comment was a good one, John, that, you know, blood atonement was not an excuse to just go out and shoot your enemies. It had more to do with the person whose blood was spilled was atoning for sins that that person had committed in the past. And it was a doctrine apparently taught by Brigham Young and other church leaders at the time, no longer taught by the church, but it was responsible for the fact that Utah, until very recently, was a state that permitted people condemned to death to opt for a shooting squad rather than firing squad, rather than the gas chamber or some other method of dying.
Sure. Well, and I guess that, you know, that is a significant legacy, and it does suggest in a, you know, very unusual way, a certain theological concern for the person who's going to be killed. I just don't think it had much to do with the instances of vigilantism or extralegal violence in Utah.
Got it.
And you know, I didn't explain it quite as clearly as I might have. And that rhetoric, I mean, Brigham Young, you know, he employs that rhetoric on a number of occasions. You know, suggests that murderers, adulterers, maybe apostates, you know, merit death in that manner. And you know, he preaches the doctrine so strongly that, you know, people, you know, a few people, you know, confess to grievous sins such as adultery and offer their heads. And his response is, you know, repent, don't do it again. You know, keep your head. And you know, then there are instances in which people are killed, but they're not killed because Brigham Young is preaching the doctrine of blood atonement. They're killed because they're troublemakers for the church, or they're considered, in particular, they're considered enemies during the Utah War. It just didn't make sense to me to connect these things to blood atonement.
Well, totally. Real quick, two quick questions before we move on to the pioneer migration. What do we make of the fact that Brigham Young and Emma didn't quite seem to get along and that Emma chose not to go with Brigham Young? What was that about?
I think it was ultimately about polygamy. There's some little bit of evidence that Emma was already had a poor opinion of Brigham Young because of his acceptance of the doctrine before Joseph's death. They never meet after Joseph's death. They're both traumatized in different ways. Emma, I'm sure, even more so. And I think they know that they have this issue that is going to divide them. And if I'm not mistaken, isn't Emma pregnant with Joseph's last child at the time?
Yes.
So it must have been, you know, a tremendously stressful and traumatic stretch of time for her. She doesn't oppose Brigham Young's leadership publicly, but I think they both know that they simply won't be reconciled because of this issue. There's more hope that Lucy Maxsmith, Joseph's mother, might come west. She passes through the endowment ceremony in Nauvoo, which Emma does not do. And so I think she wavers a little bit more, but ultimately decides also to remain in the East.
We've talked a lot about maybe some of the rougher and darker elements of Brigham Young during this time period, but just let's end the Nauvoo discussion. Is there any degree to which he also showed a pastoral sort of healing or emotional side where he could console the saints or warm their spirits or encourage them to carry on?
In many ways, and I'm glad you asked. I mean, he really becomes the chief priest for the people after Joseph's death. He participates in rites of healing for countless church members during these years. His sermons are very meaningful to many church members during these months in Nauvoo. And he stakes his leadership on leading the people through the sacred ordinances, namely the endowment that Joseph had introduced. And in a sense, he also stakes his leadership on the completion of the temple. And despite pressure from anti-Mormons in Illinois, which forces Brigham Young to agree to leave in the spring of 1846, you know, he perseveres, dedicates the temple, leads thousands of people through these sacred rituals, dances with the Latter-day Saints in the temple at late into the evening in Nauvoo, speaks in tongues in the temple late at night in Nauvoo in front of the people. I think that spiritual leadership inspired many to follow him west.
And what did they feel like they were doing in the temple? Is it the same as the modern day notion of just you know, doing work for those who have died? I know the answer, but I'm going to ask you to sort of help us understand what the temple and the temple ordinances meant to all those Nauvoo saints, because it might have been slightly different than what the temple means to us today.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's a little bit hard for me to talk about that as an outsider to the church. You know, my experience of Mormon temples is limited to open houses in Ochre Mountain and Brigham City. So, you know, I come with pretty limited knowledge in that respect. In Nauvoo, the, you know, it's first and foremost about thousands of Latter-day Saints passing through the endowment ceremony, which in many ways had the same meaning, even if some things have changed. You know, the sacred drama that I think most simply encapsulated the plan of salvation for Latter-day Saints.
And just to make it clear, John, we're talking here about endowments for themselves as opposed
right.
to for their dead ancestors.
Right.
At that point, there's so little time. And
right.
so many people who want to go through, you know, Brigham and the other apostles are working from morning till night just to accommodate them.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Yeah, thanks for the clarification, Morris, which was, I know that's what John was asking about in his question, and I digressed. Yeah, no, it wasn't so much about doing work for ancestors in Nauvoo. It was the endowment ceremony, sealings in marriage, and then a new ordinance that's really introduced by Brigham Young of adoption, and also sealing between parents and children. So those are the primary aspects of temple work in Nauvoo.
Describe adoption, just because our listeners won't, a lot of our listeners won't really know about that, because it was, as I understand it, it ended in 1890 or so. Just describe adoption really quick.
Sure. Well, the basic idea was that, you know, behind really all of these ceremonies was creating a chain of redeemed humanity that ultimately would stretch back to Adam. And for people who did not have parents in the church, adoption was a way to connect themselves to that chain of priesthood. And so a number of mostly couples, really, were adopted to Brigham Young and one of his wives or to other church members. Occasionally, this was performed for single men as well. So I think several dozen individuals were adopted to Brigham Young in the Nauvoo Temple. And then the ritual, the ordinance, is not performed until after the dedication of the St. George Temple.
So that's men being sealed to men, right?
Men being sealed to men, but more often couples being sealed to couples. Although, you know, the primary meaning seemed to be, as you suggested, you know, creation of links between men.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive. Do this and joy, your hearts will swell. Just we shall dwell.